Welcome to Clinician Voice. I'm Robin Geiger, Senior VP of Clinician Advocacy for Ingenovis Health. It is an honor to have this week's guest to join our podcast in recognition of National Physicians Week. Let's start with his very abbreviated, but still quite lengthy, bio. Dr. Adam Brown is a practicing board-certified emergency physician, entrepreneur, professor, and accomplished healthcare executive. He's the owner and CEO of ABIG Health, a healthcare strategic marketing and advisory firm. In addition to advising a suite of clients, he is the chief medical officer and head of marketing and communications at Radiant Healthcare and Radiant Data Systems. He also is a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Keenan Flagler School of Business, where he teaches healthcare operations and strategy and serves on multiple advisory boards. Dr. Brown is a regular commentator on the state of healthcare in America, having appeared in numerous national and international news outlets. He's also the author of a column for MedPage Today called Prescriptions for a Broken System. He lives in Washington, D.C. with his husband, Steve, and their Great Dane, Oscar. It is my pleasure to welcome to the podcast, Dr. Brown.
Hey, thanks, Robin. I appreciate you having me today.
Thanks for being here. May I call you Adam?
Absolutely. Please do.
Okay. I'm really excited to get into this topic with you. So let's get into it. If you could start by sharing more about ABIG Health with us.
Sure. So ABIG started when I left my old corporate job, and I started thinking about what are some things that I could do to impact healthcare. And there were so many activities that I really enjoyed throughout my career: patient care, media, communications, creativity, teaching, making a broad impact and working with different companies and different organizations to do that. And so I came up with the idea of ABIG Health. And so what we do at ABIG is we really operate through two different lanes. One is a marketing and communications lane, where we support early stage healthcare companies in their marketing and communication journey. Oftentimes, earlier stage companies can't afford the very large, expensive, big box companies. And that's where a company like mine comes in and provides expert support, design services, web services, et cetera. We also provide advisory services. And so I have a team of advisors from healthcare executives, chief nursing officers, legal executives, marketing specialists, operations teams, of course, clinician executives like myself, to help early stage companies navigate the new market that they're wanting to enter. And so we help support some of the gaps that companies may have in their early stages of development. So that's basically what we do, Robin.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And so it sounds like you from your bio and everything you just shared with me, you have a wealth of experience in healthcare. What are you most passionate about?
That's really tough. And when you ask an emergency physician what they're most passionate about, it's a challenge. One of the reasons why we did emergency medicine is because we like so many different things. And it's hard for us to stay completely focused on the one thing. You can look at my bio from that. But I have to say, I think one of the things that I love the most is the aspect of teaching. So as you mentioned, I teach at Chapel Hill. That's where I went and did my MBA. I'm from North Carolina, so I have a lot of affinity to the school there. And when I was asked to go back and teach in the business school, I saw this as such an amazing opportunity because I was now training and working with the future business leaders of healthcare, from hospital-based services, clinician services, to also health tech companies, finance, and even companies outside of healthcare, where these leaders have a very important role in how they impact the lives of their employees and their teammates. And so I saw the work that I could do at Chapel Hill as having a really great impact. So that's most likely, I would say, one of the areas that I love the most. Of course, I love patient care as well. So it's hard to not say that I enjoy that, because I absolutely do. But the teaching I see has the great ripple effect and the opportunity to train not only this generation, but future generations as well.
Okay. And, you know, we brought you on the podcast for all of your knowledge, of course, but also because of some of the similarities in your work and where you're really making an impact. So you have a background in staffing and you've worked in staffing as a physician. I'd like to talk about clinician burnout. I know we talk about it. We hear it all the time. I don't think we'll ever stop talking about it, but I'd like to talk about it mainly from the physician experience and how this resonates with your history of work.
Sure. So as you mentioned, in my previous job, I was responsible for over 600 plus emergency departments across the country. And when I stepped into that role, that was in January 2020. And fun fact, just about 4 years ago is when COVID was announced as an international pandemic. And that was a very tough time to be stepping into an executive role, a role working with clinicians across the nation and organizations and hospitals and emergency departments across the nation as well. But to your question, the focus on burnout, I think, started to shift at that time. One, from where we started seeing more and more clinicians suffer with depression, with post-traumatic stress. We saw an increase, of course, in suicidality, unfortunately, during COVID. And some wanted to attribute all of the issues focused on burnout to what was going on during the COVID pandemic. But what you and I both know as clinicians is that this has actually been going on for a long time and has been building up. And COVID exacerbated a problem that has been there for a long time. So when you ask the question, you know, something saying that we will be dealing with clinician burnout for forever, I hope that's not the case. I hope that we can identify those antecedents to the burnout, recognizing the system-based effects and the causes of burnout, not just on the personal level, but on what are those system-wide antecedents to burnout? Is it staffing matrix, staffing mix, the technology that's there to support us or not support us? What are those things that are driving that day in and day out challenge? That's most likely, I believe, one of the big things that we have got to fix. But there's a second thing, Robin, I see that we have to focus on. And that is truly giving a window and opening or widening the aperture for people who want to go into medicine to give them a true view of what life is going to be like once they
practice. Right.
And I see that there is oftentimes an expectation mismatch that occurs between what we're taught in medical school and how we're told things will be, and then what it actually is on the other side of that tunnel. And once we cross, go through the tunnel, come out the other side, we realize, oh my gosh, this is not what I thought it would be. How much administrative typing and back turning do I have to patients while I'm trying to document their history? Right. How many times do I feel like I'm understaffed or under-resourced or under pressure to make things or do things that really seem impossible on a day in and day out basis? That is something we've got to start preparing people for. We've got to start recognizing that, you know, our medical students, nursing students need to see what life is like. But also there's a responsibility on us who have come through the tunnel to say, okay, how do we change it to match that expectation? So it's more like what we all wanted to do is focus on the care of the patient and patient care solely.
Right. No, I agree completely. Transparency is everything. And as a nurse, nursing history and background, that transparency just wasn't there. I mean, it looks so, and I've spoken about this before, it looks so romanticized. You're going to come out and you're making money and you look really cute in your scrubs and you get your nice car, but there's so much more to unpack from that. And so I'm hoping that they create that transparency in academia as well as in, you know, the field so they understand and help prepare them. So there's a lot of focus now specifically on nursing burnout. And primarily there was some interest and some focus on physician, more so now on nursing burnout. I don't know if there's really a specific profession that it aligns to. What's your opinion on that? And does this align with your thinking that it's primarily nursing focused?
So I come from a slightly different perspective because I worked so closely with physicians, especially in my previous role in my in staffing, as you mentioned, and I'm a physician myself. So, so my focus is a bit, I would say, different. What I am starting to see is that for a long time, there was a focus on nursing burnout. And part of the reason and rationale for that is because we have seen for such a long time shortages in nursing staffing across the board. I mean, being an ER physician, I can't tell you the last time I worked in an ER where we had a full complement of either nurses in the ER or nurses up on the floor to where we truly were able to use the bed space that the hospital had available to them. And so I think that going back into the early 2000s to 2010s, recognizing the nursing shortages and the potential cause of the nursing shortages being burnout was one of the reasons it became discussed and talked about a lot more. But I think as you kind of go into the 2010s, into 2000s, then of course, during COVID, we started seeing more discussion around burnout in the clinician space. And I think from the ER perspective, a physician, Dr. Lorna Breen, was one that many of us had either first or second degree connections to. She was an emergency physician in New York who sadly committed suicide during the first couple of months of the COVID pandemic. And there's now an act in Congress that passed in 2021, called the Dr. Lorna Breen Act. Now, many of us have either knew Lorna firsthandedly. I did not, but I knew people who were in residency with her. And so the ripple effect of people who worked or knew her, and then throughout emergency medicine, the recognition that Houston, we have a problem. We have a problem. We need to, as doctors, start talking about depression. We need to talk about suicidality, suicide attempts. We need to start identifying, why does this occur? Why is it happening? How do we prevent it? And what do we need to do, not only as physicians, but as health systems, as leaders, as support systems, to ensure that this doesn't happen again? Physicians commit suicide twice the rate of the general population. Why? And we've not been talking about it. And so when your metric of success of programs is preventing suicide, it becomes extraordinarily important to recognize what we need to do to prevent it. So in the emergency medicine space, because of Lorna, because of the congressional and signed into law, Dr. Lorna Breen Act, there's been more focus in clinician burnout, suicide prevention than I think that we have seen before. And I think that's a very good thing. Side note, political note, that authorization for a reauthorization of the Dr. Lorna Breen Act is happening now. So we need folks to get out there and support that act. And what that act does, let me just say super quick, is it provides training, resources, and also studies the cause and antecedents of burnout and how to prevent it. There's other things we can talk about later, but those are some of the important things that are being done right now and why I think we're now starting to see a shift into the physician space.
No, thank you for sharing that. I agree. And what we found at Ingenovus, you know, with the research that we've done and definitely the support systems that we put in place with the ACT program, we found that it's not just nurses, it's not just physicians, it's all clinicians and frontline clinicians and administrative teams. It's, you know, everyone has reach or an impact with clinician burnout or some type of learned or lived experience with it. So all of the different types of elements and contributing factors are just, I think we have to attack really one at a time. We have to really focus on getting everything that's happening and contributing. Thank you for sharing that. I'd like to just shift a bit to discuss wellness. Through everything that we've seen with health systems, responding to the overall experience with COVID-19, and then reintegrating support models for clinician and patient safety, like they're now chief wellness officers roles, chief well-being officer roles and several types of wellness models. If you were to define wellness, what does that look like to you?
It's such a funny question because it's an important question. But in my class at Chapel Hill, in the very first class, I ask the students, define health. What is health? And invariably, well, 60%+, I will say, of the students will define health as wellness. Then I'll ask them to define wellness, and they'll come back and say, ooh, that's tougher. And so, and then they'll come back to health. And so it becomes a circular type of argument. But in general, I think most people have aligned to the fact that wellness is generally a state of being, of having joy, having happiness in whatever state of health that you may be, and then doing the things that you need to do to continue to add to states of happiness. Of course, there's resilience in there as well. You know, having some of the tools and the skills for resiliency, but that should not be a state of being. That should be a skill or a tool that you reach to when you need it, but in general is more of happiness. But you ask more so about just about wellness. You know, I look at wellness as having a balanced portfolio of activity. You know, anytime you meet with a financial advisor, this is my business hat coming on, you know, they will talk to you about the importance of a balanced portfolio or a risk-adjusted, diverse portfolio, depending on where you are in your state of life. Our lives should be no different, meaning that we should have a diversified portfolio within our life as well. And that means of activities, of things that we enjoy, of friendships, of things that fill us and fill our cup. And so for me, I recognize that, and this I recognize also as a place of privilege, but I do not want to practice full time. I recognize for me, practicing full time was not good for me and did not fully accomplish all of the goals that I wanted to do. So being creative in my company, ABIG, and working with marketing and communications, being an exercise. I exercise every day. And as you and I have talked about before, I crazily teach spin class one day a week at one of the local gyms. I have my dog, which for our company, we have just announced he has risen to the ranks of chief happiness officer.
I love it.
And so there are things like that, and then of course there's teaching. Some people will say to me, oh my God, Adam, it sounds like you've got your hands in so many different things. And the answer is yes, because I have a portfolio, just like my 401k. Why is that good for me? That's good for me because I'm ticking off the things that fill my cup, the values that I have in the life that I want to live, and truly allows me to follow that North Star of impact. So for other individuals, they're going to have different desires and different interests, but finding that and seeing how clinical medicine fits into that, balancing the needs of the family and also the needs of the personal health, I think are very critical in the long term. Last thing I'll say is, I know that that's not realistic for a lot of people that are listening. They're just getting by with trying to pay for the things that they need to pay for, working as much as they can, balancing the needs of kids, family, home. It's okay to be uncomfortable, but you need to have discomfort with intention. Meaning, have a period of time that you say, okay, this is uncomfortable. I know why this is uncomfortable, and this is why I'm doing what I'm doing to accomplish a goal. You should not be uncomfortable in perpetuity without intention. And that's when you turn from wellness to unwellness. And so that's something that we've got to watch very closely.
Absolutely. And you hit like all the right buttons just now, because you were talking about my overall picture. And I speak on this often of, you really need that balance of physical, mental health, spiritual, financial health, and also social health with family and friends. You have to have that nice balance to have overall health. So I'm glad that you talked on that. And I know also that you teach at a business school in Paris and London as a visiting professor. And I'm wondering, is the thinking similar there as well, as far as wellness models?
It is. So in Europe, you know, my reason for teaching there is I have always loved being in Europe. I'm there quite frequently. I was a French major and Spanish minor in college, as well as biochem. Okay, I'm a nerd. But so I've always enjoyed being over in Europe, learning, interacting. And so when a colleague paired me up with the heads of one of the schools there in Paris, I jumped at the opportunity to teach students there. What is different is there's a different social contract in Europe. And this, and what I mean there is more of a recognition of we're all in this boat together, meaning as a society. And right. So we're going to ensure that everyone has some level of base healthcare or base opportunity. Right. So whether that's paying for medical school, paying for pharmaceutical drugs, paying for healthcare. So when I speak with students there, and my students there are PharmDs and MBA students, they're most of them have their PharmDs already, and then they're MBA students. When I speak with them, they're kind of shocked at the hustle that we have in the United States, and oftentimes the lack of focus on our families or on ourselves or on that time of separation from work. They do right. see us as workaholics. Mm-hmm. Now, I think you can actually hybridize both of those type of systems to find a good balance, to use that term. I like the hustle, but I also like some of the balance and the social safety nets and the collective kind of we're in this together. So their sense of wellness is slightly different from ours because of that reason. They've put it wellness into their, I say social contract. I mean, like it's legislated how much time people have off, childcare, things that we oftentimes look at in the United States that are really hard and burdens on families. Some of those things have been taken care of. Am I saying that's a health policy thing that's right? In some cases it is. But what I do think it is a difference and one that we may want to learn from.
Right. Well, I'm glad that you shared that perspective. It's definitely, it's interesting for you to teach on both of those sides and see those different models interact and play out together. So there's been a lot of talk about resilience and different aspects and onus for attaining resilience to counter the many challenges that clinicians face in healthcare. I mean, you touched on resilience just a bit, but I'd like to talk about it a little bit more. How do you maintain that resilience and reduce the possibility of burnout for yourself? You've mentioned staying healthy and exercise. Do you think that that's something that clinicians should own?
You know, so I think we have a definitional problem with resilience. Mm-hmm. Resilience is the act of coming through a difficult, discrete time. It's the act of leaning on certain support structures and your own skills. And one of those skills is leaning on support structures, mind you,
right.
to get through a traumatic type of event. I kind of describe it this way. You have a house fire, or you have a hurricane. I mean, I'm from Eastern North Carolina. We had hurricanes all the time. You see the resilience of a community after destruction of a hurricane. I think you're right. from Florida, so you get that.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
So that is a discrete disaster. There's trauma associated with it. There's damage that's associated with it. Mm-hmm. And you as a family, you yourself, you pull together with the community to try to fix your house, to fix your community, to put things back together. In healthcare, for some reason, we've taken that word resilience and we've turned it back on the clinician to say, you just have to always be resilient. You have to always be rebuilding your house during the hurricane, fixing the pipes, pumping the floodwaters out of the house. You've got to always be doing that. And you can't really talk to anybody about it, because if you talk about it, there's a potential it could go on your file for credentialing and be seen as a sign of weakness.
Right.
So I have a problem, honestly, and you and I talked about this a bit. Like right. I have a problem with the idea of long-term telling physicians, let's train you with the skill set of resiliency, because some psychologists will tell us that that makes us too willing to accept adversity. It makes us too willing to accept a boring, unrealistic, even harmful, under-resourced, overworked, undue burdened, unsupportive type of task. And so when I talk about, when I think about resilience and I talk to people about it, I said, wait a minute, we have to recognize that if we are having to train our clinicians on resilience, we have a system-based problem.
Right.
We have to fix the system. We have to identify the antecedents of why we would need to fix resilience in the first place. Now, can we give clinicians tools for resiliency?
Absolutely.
Yes. But we cannot put the onus on clinicians to completely fix a system-based problem. And that system-based problem, as when I talk to my MBA students, goes oftentimes to how we're financially incentivized in the U.S. healthcare system, how insurance companies have had declines in reimbursement, ratcheted down on the amount of money flowing into hospitals, which has put more strains on hospitals, decreased the amount of pay, decreased the amount of staffing, and in return, over time, that has started to trickle down on clinicians. There's not a clinician that I don't speak to when you make the connection of reimbursement from payers, reimbursement from CMS, reimbursement from private payers, on how it affects the whole system as to a very likely, not all likely, but very likely cause of some of the problems within our system. So when you start to say that, we're not going to fix this problem until we fix some of the financial drivers that are causing some of the reasons for having to be resilient. That said, I do think there is some importance for physicians when they are feeling well to stay well by portfolioing their life,
right,
identifying support structures, investing in those support structures so that when things do get bad, then they seek help for it and know who to seek. On the flip side, if you feel that you are constantly being resilient, again, Houston, we have a problem. We have a system problem. We have a workplace problem. And trying to identify how to get out of that situation to protect yourself and your family, even the life of yourself, that becomes very important.
I agree. Well said. And there's a lot there. And it comes to me, my thoughts on this is definitely there's a difference with self-preservation and self-advocacy, and then also owning systemic challenges. And we have to make sure we understand where that line draw, where to draw that line and where to speak up and how to get involved. And you mentioned earlier about, you know, making sure you have your eyes on some of the political aspects that are happening and getting involved. That's part of this self-advocacy and self-preservation of the profession in general, not just, you know, of yourself and your own role, but advocating to make everything better because it does impact all clinicians. So yeah, thank you for unpacking that. That's huge. And I wanted you to touch on that because I speak on resilience a lot, and we do want to make sure that clinicians understand what resilience is and how it pertains to them, but they don't have to own every challenge that comes across or be prepared for every challenge. You may not be prepared for every challenge. We saw that with COVID-19.
That's exactly right. You know, I used to describe COVID, people were like, oh, you know, this is a marathon, not a sprint. And I've said to people, well, you know, all of my friends and colleagues, I do not do marathons. I do long distance cycling, but not marathons. But you have to train for that. We got thrust into this type of activity. We got thrust into this pandemic. And the pandemic, from the virus perspective, went through waves, but there was also psychological waves on a society perspective. It went from rallying around clinicians to then tired of the virus, then anti-vaccination activities, and then sometimes taking it out on clinicians. And you see this kind of wave of activity that kind of happened afterwards, and that dissonance, clinicians were not ready for. I mean, I wasn't ready for it. And so I think you're absolutely right. You know, there are pieces of that that we own. pieces of that, lots of pieces we don't own. And so how to deal with that is critical. One thing I will say, you mentioned advocacy, Robin, and I encourage clinicians and nurses from across the healthcare spectrum to realize that our voices are so much stronger together than they are separate. Right. There is a siloing and tribal mentality that occurs within healthcare. I saw it in medical school. Oh, they're going to be surgeons. They're the this. Or they're going to be family practice doctors. They're the that. Or when then in residency, there's like, oh, they're just ER doctors. Or, oh, they're internists. They don't understand whatever. And that has that what seems to be not a big deal becomes a really big deal when our societies, our internal medicine, our emergency medicine, our nursing societies, our PA societies, our nurse practitioner societies start to have the internal fighting while the big tsunami is coming for all of us.
Yeah, we're missing it. We're missing
and that. Missing it because we're too busy infighting. And so I truly believe that as our society, I'm not talking about the United States society, I'm talking about the professional societies, must start working more collaboratively together, identify the antecedents to these things that we've been talking about, to being unwell, to suicide, to burnout, to those sort of things, to what's making the system unhealthy, what's making our patients unhealthy, and start to speak with a unified voice. That's what the insurance industry has done. That is what other corporations and large organizations have done. We need to start doing that as well. Otherwise, we'll become and continue to be victims in some ways of the system instead of truly being able to advocate for ourselves.
You're right. And, you know, it brings me to, and I know you're pretty humble in these rights, but thanking you for being a part of our Chief Nurse Advisory Board. It's an interdisciplinary board of, just as you mentioned, all of these different professionals working together to really advocate for clinicians, and your role there is impactful and huge. So thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you. I love it.
You just unpacked that. So I appreciate that. And then just to move on, because I could sit and talk about this all day, but to move on, what advice do you have for clinicians who may be concerned about approaching burnout or feeling overwhelmed in their roles about this self-advocacy? Because we just talked about this a little bit.
Right. So it's funny. My trainer I was doing my ab workout when he got the text message that he got into medical school. And so we still joke about that. And so he's getting ready to go to medical school this summer. And so he asks me, we talk all the time about what are things that he should do? What's advice? And I say to him, Connor, I want you to remember right now all of the really cool things that you have done to get you into medical school. Mm-hmm. He works at the NIH, he trains, he plays instruments, all of these different things. Don't forget those things, because some people will do some of those things because they want to get into medical school, but most people do many of those things because they actually like and are good at many of those things. When you get into medical school, then residency, there's a tendency to start to not play the piano anymore, not to travel as much, to just get very focused on medicine. And because partially we have to. But I encourage people who are out of that training process or even in the training process to never forget the things that got them into their professional school in the first place and to continue to work on those. It becomes really important because it makes you more than just your title. I saw someone say the other day, physicians should only focus on patients. Period. And Robin, I looked at that sentence and on the surface, it's like, yeah, sure, physicians should only focus on patients. But then I really started thinking about it. I'm a human. Being a doctor, it's in the title, it's in my name. but I'm still a human. I have things I enjoy. I have things I like. There's things I want to do. There's relationships I have, friends I want to meet with to make me well. And so we as doctors and nurses and as healthcare executives, we have to remember the importance that we are more than our profession, because we cannot do well at our profession if we don't do those things that made us good medical students or good nursing students or good MBA students. I'm not talking about going to the bars all night.
You see my face. I'm like,
right? But I am talking about just doing sometimes the things that really that got us where we were, and reminding ourselves of that.
No, I agree. And we often reach for those things when we feel burdened or when we feel really stressed. So that's a good thing to do that, but it's nice to just kind of keep that into the fold of activities that you have going on. I always forget just how much I enjoy sewing. I love to cook. I mean, that's evident. You can see it when you look at me, but I love sewing, you know, so when I get there, I mean, it actually just gives me that respite, that piece of that break. So just keeping those into your daily thing, if you can, would be a really good way to kind of present to set yourself up for success.
That's exactly right.
Right. So looking toward the future, what do you hope to see in terms of addressing and preventing physician burnout, as well as burnout for all clinicians within the healthcare system?
Sure. Well, I think there's immediate things and then there's more long-term things. So let's hit the immediate first. So immediately, I want to encourage people listening to this, if they are clinicians, encourage their medical staff office. If they're healthcare executives in hospitals, look at your medical staff office. You should not be asking nursing and physician questions about their mental health on their applications. That is private information, no more than we ask about people's diabetes or hypertension or surgical history or GYN history. We should not be asking about that. We should ask about people's level of competency and ability to complete tasks. But asking them about their mental health history has been shown study after study that prevents people with the inability oftentimes to feel that they can go get the help that they need. And that is a problem. We should not be creating barriers for clinicians. So that's an immediate. Second, we should push our state licensure boards to do the same. They should not be asking about our mental health history, no more than they should ask us when we got our last colonoscopy. It's a mental health is healthcare, period. And if we as clinicians are telling our patients that, then we should be treating our own that way as well too. So that's an immediate. The second immediate is we need to also, that's probably then the third. The third is we need to call Congress and to get them to reauthorize the Dr. Lorna Breen Act. It brings money into an important space for us to continue to research and support clinicians. And that's not just physicians, that's nurses as well. Right. In the midterm, I think we need to start doing a better job in the educational program in our medical schools and nursing schools. We do not do a great job in ensuring that our clinicians are educated on the realities of what the world looks like afterwards. We don't teach them about the business of healthcare. We don't teach them. And I'm not talking about finance and accounting. I'm talking about how does money flow through the system? What are the drivers? What, you know, how does money come into a practice or not? Because those become the things that actually influence the lives of clinicians much more so than we'd like to think about. And then in the longer term, and this is one where it's more so for clinicians to take an introspective look, to identify what truly were the times in their lives that were some of their most happy moments. It may be now. It may have been something that happened 3 years ago. And then to identify from those peak times and those peak experiences, those themes. Was it being creative? Was it teaching? Was it taking care of patients? Was it being a part of a team? Was it having autonomy? What are those things thematically, those five or six that you can say in your life that you can draw out of the things that you need to truly make you happy? And then calibrate the work that you're currently doing to that list of five or six things. If there's not matches that are happening, we've got a problem. Okay. That means that you've got to start finding. That doesn't mean you wind down medicine. That just means you may need to find what other activities can match those values. So I appreciate those questions because I do think there are real opportunities in the near term, but I also see that there's opportunities for the long term. And probably the longest term thing is really looking at how our system is financed fully. I'm not advocating for a universal healthcare system / socialized medicine system. That's not what I'm looking at. What I'm looking at is how do we start to create a system that honors outcomes, how it reduces disparities and inequities, how does it improve the clinician and nursing experience, and how does it improve the patient's experience and outcomes? How do we do that in such a way that we still have financial profitability across the board? That's the system that we should be looking at.
I agree. I think you definitely touched on one of my passions, health equity, and talking about, you know, some of those opportunities there. And not equality specifically, but making sure that everyone has the ability to access healthcare is what I'm talking about, and in the way that they have the ability in their way. But you also talked about transparency in that, and that's almost like a repetitive thing, hearing that over and over again, that we don't have enough transparency, and how much that transparency would be helpful in just getting rid of stigmas and silos. Yeah, I think once you ask someone over and over again if they have a mental health issue, then they're worried about what the answer yes might imply to their career.
Exactly. Yeah. I remember there were times in residency when, and even afterwards, I've had colleagues of mine go through periods of depression and talk about the fear of actually seeing a psychologist or a psychiatrist because of the fear of having to put on their reappointment application that they had a mental health condition, or that Absolutely. They were admitted, or that they were. And just think, why are we treating our physicians and our nurses as if they can't be full functioning members of society with a skill who are living with a disease process that's treated?
Right.
Why are we even setting that up? So that's something I'm very passionate about. And I put it on my LinkedIn profile very frequently that it's a tactic that hospitals can take to reduce the stigma for clinicians. I've written about it. I mean, that's a very important space.
And, you know, it's been great to speak with you today, but wrapping up, is there anything else you would like to share today with our listeners?
Yeah. So the last thing is I really want to share about the importance of portfolioing your life. It is recognizing that you are more than your profession, that you are. And while that's such a critical part because you spent years doing it and training for it, irrespective of the space that you're in healthcare, it's clearly important. But recognize that having a portfolio of activities surrounding your profession is actually protective of that profession. Think about doing some of those activities as just as important as CEUs or CMEs for relicensures. Because if you don't continue to support those other things that make you who you are, and sometimes we've forgotten who we are, remind ourselves, ask friends to remind ourselves, but do those things so that you can truly support and be more, not only a better clinician, but a better human and better person. And then that in and of itself makes you more resilient when trauma happens.
Well, Dr. Adam Brown, everyone, it has been a joy to get to know you more today and how you're supporting physicians and clinicians in healthcare. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and giving me the opportunity to speak on these issues. I really appreciate it.
Great. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. We hope that you will continue to listen in, follow the podcast, and find something inspirational that resonates with you on each episode of The Clinician Voice.